58, Carl Swanson versus Jerry Whitworth. Hello, Mr. Pringle. Take your time. Take your time. Come on up.
Judge, I'm Steve Porter.
Oh.
Your Honors, it's pleased.
I'm sorry.
I'm pleased to be here. There is some confusion on the sign-up sheet when we got here. First of all, we were told that we would have 10 minutes for argument, and then we found out
3 for rebuttal.
My co-counsel, Dwight Pringle from Colorado, is here to argue a 3-minute rebuttal, but I don't think that's what's indicated on your...
No, it isn't.
I'll just argue for 12 minutes, and he can argue for 3. And I'd like to also introduce to you Kathy Weitharn, who is one of the plaintiffs and one of my clients.
Hello.
Unfortunately, Carl Swanson is a sole proprietor of an engineering consulting firm, and he's on a major project and just could not get free to be here today.
It's okay.
So, Your Honor.
Well, now that you've introduced her, could you tell me what her equal protection claim is in this dispute? Not her property. It's not her fence. It was not her building permit.
That's right. She's not.
Now, I understand she was treated badly. Rudely, what have you.
Right.
But that's not an equal protection claim, is it?
Well, she was...
Could we agree that she really has no equal protection claim?
I would not agree to that. I understand the question.
That makes me suspicious of the rest of your argument. I cannot understand what her claim can be. Can you tell me what it is?
Well, she acted as an agent for Carl Swanson.
An agent.
She actually was spending most of the time in the property.
Right. And I understand she has information to provide, but does she have an equal protection interest here?
We believe she does, Your Honor.
All right. Describe it to me. Tell me where it comes from.
Well,
what's it about?
You know, the essence of this level of rational basis equal protection is that the government takes some sort of action that is not rationally based on
what action did the government take adverse to her interests here?
They
was she seeking a permit for herself, her own fence, her own property?
No, not for herself. She was seeking it for Carl Swanson and for her own benefit to erect a fence and a barrier because she was the one that was primarily in the property. She was primarily the target and the victim of Jerry Whitworth's harassment, including some very juvenile behavior on his part of making faces at her and dancing around in front of the window of her home. And she was the one who was mainly present to deal with Joe Atwood, the building inspector. She was the one who was there when the mayor is dancing around in the street saying, "Shall I call the cops? Shall I call the cops?" We believe that she was the victim of government action, of the building code enforcement.
Was she cited? Was she required to appear at that hearing?
No.
Citation was issued to Mr. Swanson.
To Mr. Swanson, correct. Yeah. Correct. We believe she suffered the brunt of the distress.
Is there another case where an agent maltreated like this is found to have an equal protection claim?
I can't think of one in a class of one. I can certainly think of the significant other instance where in a racial discrimination case a woman is discriminated against because her husband's a member of a different race.
Those sorts of things. Associational discrimination, I can understand that. Sure.
Right, and we believe that she suffered emotional distress as a result of bearing the brunt of that.
I'm not talking about your state law claims. I'm talking about U.S. Constitution, equal protection.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I could offer to you standing here today, Your Honor, is the analogy to a person who's not a member of a suspect class but is treated as if she were because of her association with somebody who is.
All right.
Okay.
Shall I proceed?
Please.
You know, Your Honor, I guess, Your Honor, where I'd like to start is with Esmail versus McCrane, in which this court said, if the power of government is brought to bear on a harmless individual merely because a powerful state or local official harbors a malignant animosity toward him, the individual ought to have a remedy in federal court.
Well, let me just say that what you just quoted really brings me to my sort of bottom line issue here. Does a plaintiff need to show that he was similarly situated to other persons who were treated more favorably if he can show instead direct evidence of animus?
Your Honor, what we'd like to suggest to the court, and of course, as the court observed in the recent Delmar Cell case, is that the law concerning class of one equal protection claims is in flux. And fortunately or unfortunately, Delmar Cell did not resolve.
The whole of it is dicta.
Yeah. However, I think
Well, I raise a different question. This is just the adverse of that.
But I guess what we'd like to suggest, Your Honor, is there's no doubt there are cases which the district court relied on in this case that erect a very high barrier with regard to the comparator. And they do that because of really a concern for protecting the seriousness or the significance of constitutional claims versus ordinary tort claims or building disputes.
Those are not cases where there's a direct showing of animus, however.
Right,
exactly. The Wilenka case, which I wrote, that was a case of just the improper delivery of fire department services.
And right.
Nobody ever showed any animus that I know about in that case.
Exactly, and that's why I quoted Esmail, because
totally different question.
When I read Esmail, Your Honor, it struck me that's this case. You know, I mean, Esmail was decided at the pleading stage, true, but when Dwight Pringle brought his clients, Carl Swanson and Kathy Weathern, to me seeking legal representation and told me the story that is the factual premise of this case, it was that statement by the court in Esmail that made me think, you know, that's what's going on here. So what we want to suggest is that in addition to the issue of the malice or the animus, you know, we need to visit the comparator issue, and the court in Del Marcel did.
Why? Why?
Because
why do plaintiffs need to go through the machinations of showing they are similarly situated to others who have been treated more favorably if they can show animus, if they can show, you know, the mayor dancing around the house? And
I agree. I think that's the question. And I guess what I would say, Your Honor, is that certainly at the minimum, I mean, we are talking about equal protection here, and I suppose we have to show it made a difference that the mayor was dancing around in front of the house and that resulted in differential treatment.
Well, the word equal suggests a comparison.
Exactly. But my argument would be that, you know, that we should have sort of an inverse relationship between the animus and the comparator, such that the greater the evidence of the animus and the greater the evidence that the animus actually caused an injury, the less we should have to show, the less stringent should be the showing of the comparator. I mean, as the Wood opinion in Del Marcel indicated, you know, you can, according to that decision and arguably according to Olick, you can win just based on the different treatment. But you better have a pretty clear example then of differential treatment. But in a case like this, there was good evidence of differential treatment. There was good evidence, strong evidence, that the district court found was established of the malice. And there was good evidence that the mayor's actions had affected the way Joe Atwood had enforced the ordinances.
How about sliding scale? The more you show of one, the less of the other.
That's exactly what I was thinking of, Your Honor. And I think that makes sense. And I think that it also makes sense to say, rather than have this exact comparator as a threshold item, we ought to allow the plaintiff to show a constellation of factors, because after all, the proof that we're trying to establish is there enough for a reasonable jury to conclude that there was differential treatment here that was not rationally based in a legitimate government purpose? And we have that here. In addition to the comparator, we have the fact that these claims were frivolous, that a municipal judge who actually was not even a lawyer and a local member of the community threw these claims out at the close of the city's case in a situation where even the city had to admit at trial, well, oops, the statute really doesn't say what we're saying it says. I mean, this was not even an arguable exercise of the legitimate discretion of this building code enforcer. This was a frivolous citation. These were frivolous citations. That's another factor in the constellation we would argue should be looked at. I guess, I don't know, maybe I need to say no more, but I guess what I'm saying is I would hope that when this court revisits this, that the court would recognize that there may be a constellation of factors or indicia that can be used on a plaintiff's side to prove that essentially the government acted irrationally and illegitimately. The only other thing I would add, Your Honor, is that I think that if you accept the extreme level of deference that this judge gave to the city on the comparator issue, I would just suggest if we had established all the elements that the judge required, there would be no rational jury that could decide against the plaintiff. And in my view, if you set a standard that high, you have usurped the function of the jury. So
I wanted to ask you about Ms. Everly's situation, her fence intruding onto the Swanson property. The ordinance was changed before that was reported, wasn't it? Didn't the ordinance change in October of 2007?
It changed in October. Standing here, I'm not sure I can tell you whether it did or not.
Yeah, I think it did. I think it was changed in October of 2007.
I know it did change in October of 2007.
Yeah, after Swanson was cited, but before the report about Everly was made. So does that affect her status as a comparator?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because it's my understanding, the ordinance itself said that the 3-foot rule that the city was trying to impose was really no 3-foot rule at all. Not only did it not apply to a fence that was less than 4 feet, but in addition to that,
In the ordinance, there was a 3-foot setback in the ordinance that was applicable when
exactly.
Everly's was noticed.
So if anything, it made it less of an opportunity for Mr. Atwood to exercise his discretion. It indicated even more strongly that Atwood was bending the rules for Everly in a situation where he was trying to fabricate or gin up a claim against Swanson.
It makes me wonder, though, whether she's an adequate comparator.
Well, that depends on what do you mean by comparator. If you say the ordinance changed and it made it more strict and he still let her off the hook, and when the ordinance really didn't even restrict a boundary fence, and yet it was enforced against Swanson as if it did, I think that creates even a greater disparate treatment than
she never even applied for a building
right.
permit. She got one sua sponte.
Yeah.
So. Okay.
And I guess I won't take up any more of your time.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Mr. Aberg, hello. How are you? Look, it's afternoon.
I'd like to pick up, if I could, with Michelle Everly, and I actually bringing up a point that you kind of brought up on it, and that is that I think it kind of illustrates this issue about how treatment is really the same for both of those situations. Somebody's not being treated better than somebody else. As I understand this case, and it started as a complaint by Mr. Whitworth, who happens to be the mayor but does not give up his rights of being a citizen by being a mayor and has rights as a neighbor, made a complaint about something having to do with fence that was going to be constructed. Subsequently, Ms. Whitehorn made a complaint to the city, Mr. Atwood, with regard to her neighbor, Ms. Everly. So it seems to me in both of those instances that Mr. Atwood, who is functioning as the person who is issuing the building permits, came out to address both those situations in a way to try and problem solve them. With respect to Ms. Eberle, what he did was accommodate the complaint that Ms. Whitehorn had that there was a fence that was intruding on their property. He determined that that was correct, and they were able to work that out where she was able to move the fence. With respect to getting a fence up on behalf of Ms. Whitehorn and Mr. Swanson on Mr. Swanson's property, which she's now been described as being an agent for him, she was going to go in and get a permit from Mr. Atwood. There was some discussion about that. Mr. Atwood said you need a structure permit if you want to put up a fence. She indicated to him, well, this is not a structure, it's a fence. And I think also at that point in time, she probably felt that they had a structure permit already from the remodeling work that they did, because that was one of the arguments that was made at the municipal court trial as to why the lack of permit citation should be dismissed before going in. With respect to Judge Crocker's decision and his findings, I think one of the things I wanted to point out to the court is that he had two procedural points that he wanted to address as part of his opinion. First, he indicated that he did not accept at face value the parties' characterizations or summaries of facts and their proposed findings of fact, and there were proposed findings from both sides. And he said, instead, where the parties disputed the accuracy of proposed finding, I looked at the record myself to determine what the appropriate finding should be. He also indicated that he disregarded proposed findings of fact that were not supported by the cited record and that were objected to. And so with that in mind, he went through carefully and came up with the facts that he believed were undisputed for purposes of making the decision. I think he correctly made the decision that...
Ms. Porter alludes to this. In making his findings, Judge Crocker said a few things that are a little troubling here. For example, he's talking about Whitworth not being disqualified from complaining on page 16 of his opinion, and he says that Whitworth believed genuinely, it seems, that it violated the city's building code. In other words, he seems to draw the inferences in favor of the defense here.
Well, I don't know that that makes much of a difference, because if you're looking at it in terms from whether we're talking about a mayor or not, actually that's one of the concerns that I have. There's a constant reference from the plaintiffs as to Whitworth being mayor, and everything that he does is somehow clothed in being the mayor. Well, that's simply not the case. He was not acting in any official capacity or function as a mayor.
How do you parse that off?
Well, does he give up his right to be a citizen
when he shows up
by
in the
being
building
mayor?
Permit, shows up in the building permit office or whatever office Atwood's in. He's
well, one of the things that I can say that addresses that is that the only official action that the mayor is delegated to take pursuant to Wisconsin statutes is as a member of the council, and only when the council is taking action and has a tie.
And
he doesn't act otherwise.
There's some meetings immediately surrounding these events that he's at.
Right.
Look, in this case, the district court stated that the facts, quote, suggests that the mayor of Chetek employed his city's bureaucracy to wage a personal vendetta against the out-of-staters who moved in next door and undertook unwelcome remodeling and fencing projects. And my question, question is, why do the plaintiffs need to go through the machinations of showing that they're similarly situated to anybody who has been treated more favorably if they can show direct evidence of intentional discrimination?
Well, I think one of the reasons why we're looking at the similarly situated component is that was argued by the parties as part of this case. And it was part of the decision-making, and in fact really was the basis on which the court made the determination to dismiss the case on summary judgment grounds. The question that you had, Judge, I'd like to refer to the Ganofsky case, which came up kind of on short notice. I did have a chance to review it. I thought that was quite interesting. That was a case that I believe was decided on a motion to dismiss, not a motion for summary judgment, and so was judged under a 12B6 standard, then a Rule 56 standard. But I note that the court made a point of saying that in that particular instance, the plaintiff seemed to be harassed on a long-term basis for a period of 14 months, was issued numerous parking tickets, apparently on their face were obviously bogus and either were something to increase revenue for the city of Chicago or to show performance by the police department or something. And it was noted that Mr. Granovsky went seven times to court to have these claims assessed and dismissed and went to complain to the police department and they did nothing. And so he ended up bringing the case here. But we have nothing like that here. And I note that the court said in Granovsky.
There are very few cases that were such an obvious showing of animus as this case, seems to me.
Well,
and the magistrate found that.
Well,
there wasn't any argument about it. I mean, he said these people were drug dealers, for God's sake.
He threatened that. He said your dental insurance better be paid up if you come back to Wisconsin.
Well, as was pointed out, though, I think, and I think quite rightly, is there was not really a whole lot of harassment that was directed specifically toward Mr. Swanson. And, you know, certainly I agree that there was a certain amount of rude behavior. There's no question about that. But I would like to make this point that in the Ganofsky case, this court said, look, we are not inviting every driver with a couple of parking tickets, even invalid ones, to sue in federal court. Now, I recognize, and I think other counsel does as well, that with the DeMarcel case, that this is a difficult issue, not only for this circuit, but for other circuits around the country. But to address the issue that you had about...
Well, the difficult issue there was whether you have to show animus or irrational discrimination. I mean, that's... In this case, you don't ever have to think about that. You got animus right in front of you.
Well, but I think you still have to look at rational basis, which is my understanding is one of the components that still is in with regard to the leading opinion in DeMarcel with Judge Posner. And there was a concurrence with Judge Easterbrook on that particular instance. And I believe what the court said there was, quote, which is not to say that proof of a bad motive is alone sufficient to establish liability in a class of one case. The plaintiff must plead and prove both the absence of a rational basis for the defendant's action and some improper personal motive for the differential treatment.
You've
so that indicates that there is differential treatment that you have to look at, number one, and number two, that you can look at to determine whether there's a rational basis.
But you've got both here. You've got both here.
Pardon?
You have both prongs here in this case.
Well, in what I had indicated, and I argued in our case that there is a rational basis for the prosecutions that occurred here. There were ordinances in place. There were citations issued. Granted, we agree that some of the citations were dismissed before the municipal trial ever occurred. And as a result of the municipal trial, all of those citations were dismissed. Now, I had suggested in my brief to you that if they were concerned that this was a frivolous claim, they should have brought that up with the municipal court judge because that court judge could have taken that into account in making its decision, but that never came up. Now, in
he
the
threw
response...
threw the whole case out, didn't he?
Pardon?
He said he threw the whole case out.
Well, he threw the whole case out, but not on the basis of it being frivolous.
Well,
and the reply
frivolous.
Was that under Wisconsin statute 814.025, that a city attorney... couldn't be held responsible for a frivolous claim in the state of Wisconsin. First of all, I don't think that statute exists anymore, and I don't think it exists in 2008, which is when the municipal trial occurred. Since that time, I think the appropriate statute is Wisconsin statute section 802.05, which is similar to Rule 11, which requires somebody to say in advance or alert somebody in advance that your claim is frivolous.
You're not arguing a res judicata effect of the
no
of that finding.
No, I'm not. No, I'm just saying that this is something that could have been brought up and never was brought up as an issue. And with respect to 80205, my understanding is that only goes to the awarding of actual attorney's fees or costs because of a frivolous claim after there's been notice. But I don't think that necessarily is all of the power that the court might have if the issue of this frivolousness was brought up to it and it had a chance to consider it. One of the sanctions could have been specifically to dismiss the case because it was frivolous, but that never happened. So I think that's important, and I think you also have to look at the fact that there is really no evidence that I am aware of that suggests that Mr. Atwood was somehow threatened or cajoled or directed to by the mayor or anybody else in the city, for that matter, to issue these citations. Other than the fact that he
You've got the mayor in the background yelling when he's on the phone with Swanson. I mean, you've got him showing up as soon as the mayor sees something.
No, I was going to say, other than the fact that there was a council meeting with respect to it, and there was also advice from the city attorney. That is what he acted on. That's when he issued the citations, is after that meeting. So,
a jury might find that.
Well, but what I'm saying is, I still think that there is a distinction between Mr. Whitworth as an individual citizen and a neighbor. I think he still has a right to make a complaint to somebody about something. I mean, they made a complaint about Eberle. That's why I started off with that issue. I think that's a really important one to make. They complained about Eberle. Action was taken. The mayor complained about Mr. Swanson. Action was taken. They tried to work with them to get a permit. They didn't want to fill out the paperwork for a permit, then said that we don't need a permit because this is not a structure, so we're not going to get a permit. They put the fence up. Okay, what do I do now? Council meeting, talk to the city attorney, then they issue citations at that point. It's not as if there's a bunch of stuff going on and a bunch of antics going on between the parties, and then all of a sudden the citation shows up. That's not how it happened. That's not the sequence of it. So I think any jury that looks at that on the basis of those facts, and I think those are the kinds of things that Judge Crocker looked at, no reasonable jury is going to find that there was any unequal treatment, number one, or that there wasn't a rational basis for this.
There is no rational basis for it because you've got, I mean, what specifically do you have the municipal ordinance saying that make any of the differences between the two of them material?
Well, but there's always a rational basis for issuing a citation if there's been a violation. The fact that the city did not prove its case when it brought the citations that it did into the case, in fact, two of them came from the city attorney, I think probably after after Whitworth was the mayor, but I'm not sure about that. But those were things that the city attorney was dealing with. So there isn't any allegation that members of the city council or members of the city attorney had any malicious intent or anything of that matter when they were processing these issues, or for that matter that there was any malicious intent on the part of Mr. Atwood in trying to get a permit issued for this and trying to deal with the issue. As I said, he came out to deal with a complaint by Ms. Whitehorn when she complained about trespassing. He also came out and tried to problem solve when there was an issue of a complaint from Mr. Whitworth about not having a permit or not putting the fence up. So I think that there hasn't been any differential treatment here. I think there's a rational basis for what should be done or what was done. And I believe that this court should, or I'm asking that the court uphold the ruling of Judge Crocker and have this case dismissed by summary judgment, have that ruling affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Hey, Mr. Pringle.
May it please the court, I'm Dwight Pringle, as I've been previously introduced. I'd like to begin by, I think, following up on one of Judge Tender's initial questions about Ms. Weathart's standing. And in response to that, she, first of all, The district court never made a ruling on that. In fact, it reserved it. It didn't feel like the issue of her standing needed to be decided for purposes of ruling on the motion for summary judgment. Ms. Weathorn does point out to me vehemently just now that she was the one who was threatened with arrest. And as other members of the court have pointed out, she was she bore the brunt of much of this harassment, which went on for
right,
months
but,
and months.
But the unequal treatment claimed here is the issuance of the citations that required Mr. Swanson to go to the hearing and defend against those citations.
In a strict sense, that's very true. However, if you look back in the record to the incident of the tree planting, and
Well, I don't think you want to waste a lot of time on
sure.
her aspect of the case.
There was a suggestion in the argument of the city.
Do you want us to move this up for you?
Not with this short amount.
Okay.
I'll lean forward slightly.
Okay.
There was a suggestion from the council for the city that Mayor Whitworth was just another citizen and he had every right to have his complaints considered along with anyone else's. And I think if you look at the record in this case that he was not treated as any other citizen. Presumably, ordinary citizens don't get to bust into meetings and scream at public officials about the issuance of a permit. And as the district court found, Whitworth mobilized the city enforcement bureaucracy to come against Mr. Swanson. I don't think that resembles anything like the abilities of an ordinary citizen to influence the government. The court also points out that it appeared that the district court was drawing inferences, if not deciding disputed issues of fact, and did so in favor of the city. And we certainly agree that that's what the district court did. And another inference that we would cite as really a decision of fact, a disputed fact, was that Ms. Weathorn never applied for a permit. If you look at the record, she went two times. There's her testimony in the record. I believe there's an affidavit from her in the record that she went down to Atwood's office two times to get the permit. So with the intent to get the permit. So for the district court to say, well, she never applied for the permit, and there was a bureaucratic sort of runaround or some questioning, but I don't think it's fair to conclude at all that she never applied for the permit. The Janoski case was brought up, and I think one of the teachings of the Janoski case is you can look at patterns, and sometimes a pattern is enough. You don't need to you're not held to a very strict standard on providing evidence of comparators. And in fact, they said in Janoski, this stands out as so bad that you could pull a page out of the phone book and come up with hundreds of potential comparators. I think the pattern evidence in this case is that there was 10 years of zero enforcement of the building code with respect to construction of a fence. No permit had ever been denied. No stop order had ever been issued. And I see my time is up. So thank you very much, and we would ask that the trial court be reversed and the case remanded.
All right. Well, thanks to everyone, Mr. Aberg, Mr. Porter, Mr. Pringle, Ms. Weathorn for being here, and the case will be taken under advisement.